Discourses on Atisha's 7 points of mind training. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 14.
The first question. Bhagwan, can you say something about death and the art of dying? Deva Bandana, the first thing to be known about death is that death is a lie. Death exists not. It is one of the most illusory things. Death is the shadow of another lie. The name of that other lie is the ego. Death is the shadow of the ego. Because ego is, death appears to be there. The secret of knowing death, understanding death, is not in death in itself. You will have to go deeper into the existence of the ego. You will have to look, watch, observe, be aware of what this ego is. And the day you have found that there is no ego, that there has never been, it appeared only because you were not aware. It appeared only because you were keeping your own existence in darkness. The day it is understood that the ego is a creation of an unconscious mind, ego disappears, and simultaneously death disappears. The real you is eternal. Life is neither born nor dies. The ocean continues. Waves come and go. But what are waves? Just forms. Wind playing with the ocean. Waves have no substantial existence. So are we. Waves. Playthings. But if we look deep down into the wave, there is the ocean. And the eternal depth of it, and the unfathomable mystery of it. Look deep down into your own being and you will find the ocean. And that ocean is, and the ocean always is. You cannot say it was. You cannot say it will be. You can only use one tense for it, the present tense, it is. This is the whole search of religion. The search is to find that which truly is. We have accepted things which really are not. And the greatest and the central of them is ego. And of course, it casts a big shadow. That shadow is death. Those who try to understand death directly will never be able to penetrate into the mystery of it. They will be fighting with darkness. Darkness is non-existential. You cannot fight with it. Bring light, and the darkness is no more. How we can know the ego? Bring a little more awareness to your existence. Each act has to be done less automatically than you have been doing up to now, and you have the key. If you are walking, don't walk like a robot. Don't go on walking as you have always walked. Don't do it mechanically. Bring a little awareness to it. Slow down. Let each step be taken in full consciousness. Buddha used to say to his disciples that when you raise your left foot, say deep down, left. When you raise your right foot, say deep down, right. First say, so that you can become acquainted with this new process. Then slowly, slowly let the words disappear. Just remember, left, right. Try it in small acts. You are not supposed to do big things. Eating, taking a bath, swimming, walking, talking, listening, cooking your food, washing your clothes, de-automatize the processes. Remember the word de-automatization. That is the whole secret of becoming aware. Mind is a robot. The robot has its utility. This is the way how the mind functions. You learn something. When you learn something in the beginning, you are aware. For example, if you learn swimming, you are very alert because life is in danger. Are you learn driving a car? You are very alert. You have to be alert. You have to be careful about many things. The steering wheel, the road, the people passing by, the accelerator, the brake, the clutch, everything you have to be aware of. So many things. And you are nervous. And it is dangerous to commit a mistake. It is so dangerous, that's why you have to keep aware. But the moment you have learned driving, this awareness will not be needed. Then the robot part of your mind will take over it. That's what we call learning. Learning means something has been transferred from consciousness to the robot. That's what learning is all about. Once you have learned a thing, it is no more part of the conscious. It has been delivered to the unconscious. Now the unconscious can do it. Now your consciousness is free to learn something else. This is in itself tremendously significant. Otherwise you will remain learning a single thing your whole life. The mind is a great servant, a great computer. Use it, but remember that it should not overpower you. Remember that you should remain capable of being aware, that it should not possess you in toto, that it should not become all and all, that a door should be left open from where you can come out of the robot. That opening of the door is called meditation. But remember, the robot is so skillful, it can even take meditation into its control. Once you have learnt it, the mind says, now you need not be worried about it. I am capable of doing it. I will do it. You leave it to me. And the mind is skillful. It is a very beautiful machine. Functions well. In fact, all our science together and all our so-called progress in knowledge has not been yet able to create something so sophisticated as human mind. The greatest computers in existence are still rudimentary compared to the mind. The mind is simply a miracle. But when something is so powerful, there is danger in it. You can be so much hypnotized by it and its power that you can lose your soul. If you have completely forgotten how to be aware, then the ego is created. Ego is the state of utter unawareness. Mind has taken possession of your whole being. It has spread like a cancer all over of you. Nothing is left out. Ego is the cancer of the inner, the cancer of the soul. And the only remedy I say is meditation. Then you start reclaiming few territories from the mind. And the process is difficult but exhilarating. The process is difficult but enchanting. The process is difficult but challenging, thrilling. It will bring a new joy in your life when you reclaim a territory back from the robot. You will be surprised that you are becoming a totally new person, that your being is renewed, that this is a new birth. And you will be surprised that your eyes see more, your ears hear more, your hands touch more, your body feels more, your heart loves more, everything becomes more. And more, not only in the sense of quantity, but in the sense of quality too. You not only see more trees, you see trees more deeply. The green of the trees becomes greener. Not only that, it becomes luminous. Not only that, the tree starts having an individuality of its own. Not only that, You can have a communion with existence now. And the more territories are claimed, the more and more your life becomes psychedelic, colorful. You are then a rainbow, the whole spectrum. All the notes of music, the whole octave, your life becomes richer, multidimensional, has depth, has height, has tremendously beautiful valleys, and has tremendously beautiful sunlit peaks. You start expanding. As you reclaim parts from the robot, you start coming alive. For the first time, you are turned on. This is the miracle of meditation. This is something not to be missed. The people who miss it have not lived at all. And to know life in such intensity, in such ecstasy, is to know that there is no death. Not to know life creates death. Ignorance of life creates death. To know life is to know there is no death, there has never been. Nobody has ever died, I declare. Nobody is ever going to die. Death is impossible in the very nature of things. Only life is. Yes, life goes on changing forms. One day you are this, another day you are something else. Where is the child that you were one day? Has the child died? Can you say it that the child has died? The child has not died. But where is the child then? The form has changed. The child is still there in its essentiality. But now you have become a young man. Are a young woman. The child is there with all its beauty. It has been superimposed by new riches. And then one day you will become old. Then where is your youth? Died? No, again something more has happened. The old has brought its own crop. The old age has brought its own wisdom. The old age has brought its own beauties. The child is innocent. That is his core. The youth is overflowing with energy. That is his core. And the old man has seen all, lived all, known all. Wisdom has arisen. That is his core. But his wisdom contains something of the youth. It is also overflowing. It is radiant. It is vibrant. It is pulsating. It is alive. It has also something of the child. It is innocent. if the old man is not also young, then he has only aged, he is not old. He has grown in time, in age, but he is not grown up. He has missed. If the old man is not innocent like the child, if his eyes don't show that crystal clarity of innocence, then he has not yet lived. If you live totally, cunningness, cleverness disappears. Trust arises. These are the criterions to know whether one has lived or not. But the child never dies, only is metamorphosed. The youth never dies, only again a new mutation. And do you think the old man dies? Yes, the body disappears, because it has served its purpose. But the consciousness continues the journey. If death was a reality, existence would be utterly absurd. Existence would be mad. If Buddha dies, that means such a beautiful music, such splendor, such grace, such beauty, such poetry disappears from existence. Then the existence is very stupid. Then what is the point? Then how growth is possible? Then how evolution is possible? A Buddha is a rare gem. It happens only once in a while. Millions of people try, and then one person becomes a Buddha, and then he dies, and all is finished. So what is the point? No, Buddha cannot die. He is absorbed. He is absorbed by the whole. He continues. Now the continuity is bodiless. Because he has become so expanded that no body can contain except the body of the universe itself. He has become so oceanic that it is not possible to have small manifestations. Now he can exist only in essence. He can exist only as a fragrance, not as a flower. He cannot have a form. He can only exist as a formless intelligence of existence. The world has grown more and more intelligent. Before Buddha, it was not so intelligent. Something was missing. Before Jesus, it was not so intelligent. Before Muhammad, it was not so intelligent. They have all contributed. If you understand rightly, God is not something that has happened, but is happening. God is happening every day. Buddha has created something. Mahavira has created something. Patanjali has created something, Laosu, Jarathustra, Atisa, Tilopa. They have all contributed. God is being created. Let your hearts be thrilled that you can become a creator of God. You have been told again and again that God created the world. I would like to tell you, we are creating God every day. And you can see the changes. If you look in the Old Testament, the words that the God of the Old Testament utters look so ugly. Something seems to be very primitive. The God of the Old Testament says, I am a very jealous God. Can you think God and jealous? That those who don't follow me should be crushed, thrown into hell fire. That those who don't obey me, great revenge will be taken. Can you think these words being uttered by Buddha? No, the concept of God is being polished every day. The God of Moses is rudimentary. The God of Jesus is far more sophisticated, far more cultured. As man becomes cultured, his God becomes cultured. As man has more understanding, his God has more understanding. Because your God represents you. The God of Moses is law. The God of Jesus is love. The God of Buddha is compassion. The God of Atisa is utter emptiness, silence. We are searching new dimensions of God. We are adding new dimensions to God. God is being created. You are not just a seeker. You are also a creator. And the future will know far better visions of God. Buddha does not die. He disappears into our concept of God. Jesus melts into the ocean of our God. And the people who are not yet awakened, they also don't die. They have to come back again and again into some form. Because the only possibility to be awakened is through the forms. The world is a context to be awakened, an opportunity. Remember Atisa, he says, don't wait for the opportunity. Because the world is the opportunity. We are already in it. The world is an opportunity to learn. It looks paradoxical. Time is the opportunity to learn the eternal. Body is the opportunity to learn the bodiless. Matter is the opportunity to learn consciousness. Sex is the opportunity to learn samadhi. The whole existence is an opportunity. Anger is the opportunity to learn compassion. and greet the opportunity to learn sharing. And death is the opportunity to go into the ego and to see whether I am or I am not. If I am, then maybe death is possible. But if you find yourself that I am not, there is pure emptiness inside. There is nobody. If you can feel that nobodiness inside you, where is death? What is death? Who can die? Vandana, your question is significant. You ask, can you say something about death? Only one thing, that death is not. And you ask, in the art of dying, when there is no death, how you are going to learn the art of dying? You will have to live the art of living. If you know how to live, you will know everything about life, about death. But you will have to approach the positive. Never make the negative the object of your study, because the negative is not there. You can go on, and you will never arrive anywhere. Try to understand what is light, not darkness. Try to understand what is life, not death. Try to understand what is love, not hate. If you go into hate, you will never understand it, because hate is only absence of love. So is darkness, absence of light. How can you understand absence? If you want to understand me, you have to understand me, not my absence. If you want to study this chair has to be studied, not when Asis has taken it away. And you start studying the absence, what you will study? Always be alert. Never get hooked into anything negative. Many people go on studying negative things. Their energies are simply wasted. There is no art of dying, or the art of living is the art of dying. Live, but your so-called religious people have been teaching you not to live. They are the creators of death. In a very indirect way, they have created death. Because they have made you so afraid of living. Everything is wrong. Life is wrong. The world is wrong. The body is wrong. Love is wrong. Relationship is wrong. Enjoying anything is wrong. They have made you so guilty of everything, so condemnatory of everything, that you cannot live. And when you cannot live, what is left? The absence. The absence of life. And that is death. And then you are trembling. Trembling before something which is not is your own creation. And because you start trembling in great fear of death, The priest becomes very powerful. He says, don't be worried. I am here to help you. Follow me. I will save you from hell. And I will take you to heaven. And those who are within my fold will be saved. And nobody else will be saved. Christians go on saying the same thing to people, that unless you are a Christian, you cannot be saved. Only Jesus will save you. And the day of judgment is coming closer. And on the day of judgment, those who are with Jesus, he will recognize them. He will sort them out. And the others, the millions and millions, they will be simply thrown into hell for eternity. Remember, there is no escape. For eternity, they will be thrown into hell. And the same is the attitude of other religions. But people, out of fear, start clinging to something whatsoever is available in the close vicinity. If you are accidentally born in a Hindu home, or a Jaina home, or a Jew, you become a Jew, or a Jaina, or a Hindu, as the case may be. Whatsoever is available close by, the child starts clinging. My approach is totally different. I don't say, be afraid. That is the strategy of the priest. That is his trade secret. I say there is nothing to fear. Because God is in you. There is nothing to fear. Live life fearlessly. Live each moment as intensely as possible. Intensity has to be remembered. And if you don't live any moment intensely, then what happens? Your mind hankers for repetition. You love a woman. Your mind hankers for repetition. Why? For the same experience again and again. You eat certain food, you enjoy it. Now you hanker for the same food again and again. Why? The reason is that whatsoever you do, you never do it totally. Hence, something remains discontented in you. If you do it totally, there will be no hankering for repetition. And you will be searching the new, exploring the unknown. You will not move in a vicious circle. Your life will become a growth. Ordinarily, people only go on moving in circles. They appear to move, but only they appear. Growth means you are not moving in a circle. That something new is every day happening, every moment really. And when that becomes possible, whenever you start living intensely, I would like you to teach how to eat intensely, totally. How to love intensely, totally. How to do small things with such utter ecstasy that nothing is left behind. If you laugh, let the laughter shake your very foundations. If you cry, become tears. Let your heart be poured through tears. If you hug somebody, then become the hug. If you kiss somebody, then be just the lips. Then be just the kiss. And you will be surprised how much you have been missing. How much you have missed. How you have lived up to now in a lukewarm way. I can teach you the art of living. That implies the art of dying. You need not learn it separately. The man who knows how to live knows how to die. The man who knows how to fall in love knows when the moment has come to fall out of it. He falls out of it gracefully with a goodbye, with gratitude. But only the man who knows how to love. People don't know how to love, then they don't know how to say goodbye when the time has come to say it. If you love, you will know that everything begins and everything ends. And there is a time for the beginning and there is a time for ending. And there is no wound in it. One is not wounded. One simply knows the season is over. One is not in a despair. One simply understands. And one thanks the other that you gave me so many beautiful gifts, that you gave me new visions of life, that you opened few windows I may not have ever opened on my own. Now the time has come that we separate, that our ways part, not in anger. Not in rage, not with grudge, not with any complaint, but with tremendous gratitude, with great love, thankfulness in the heart. If you know how to love, you will know how to separate. Your separation will also have a beauty and grace. And the same is the case with life. If you know how to live, you will know how to die. Your death will be tremendously beautiful. The death of Socrates is tremendously beautiful. The death of Buddha is tremendously beautiful. The day Buddha died, in the morning he gathered all his disciples, all his sannyasins, and told them, the last day has come now. My boat has arrived and I have to leave. And this has been a beautiful journey, a beautiful togetherness. If you have any questions to ask, you can ask, because I will not be available to you anymore physically. A great silence fell on the disciples. A great sadness. And Buddha laughed and he said, "Don't be sad, because that's what I have been teaching you again and again. Everything that begins ends. Now let me teach you by my death too. As I have been teaching you through my life, let me teach you through my death too." Nobody could gather the courage to ask a question. Their whole life they had asked thousands and thousands of questions. And this was not a moment to ask anything. And they were not in a mood, they were crying and weeping. So Buddha said goodbye. "If you don't have any questions, then I depart." He sat under the tree with closed eyes. He disappeared from the body. This is called in Buddhist tradition, first meditation. How to disappear from the body. It means how to disidentify yourself from the body. How to know totally, absolutely that I am not the body. A question is bound to arise in your mind. Had not Buddha known it before? He had known it before. But then, a person like Buddha has to create some device. So just a little bit of him remains connected with the body. Otherwise he would have died long before. 42 years before he would have died. The day his enlightenment had happened, he would have died. Out of compassion, he created a desire. The desire to help people. It is a desire. And it keeps you attached to the body. He created a desire to help the people. Whatsoever I have known, I have to share. If you want to share, you will have to use the mind and the body. That small part remained attached. Now, he cuts even that small root with the body. He becomes disidentified with the body. The first meditation complete, the body is left. The second meditation, the mind is dropped. He had dropped the mind long before, but as a master it was dropped, as a servant it was used. Now it is not even needed as a servant. It is utterly dropped, totally dropped. And the third meditation, he dropped his heart. It was needed up to now. He was functioning through his heart. Otherwise, compassion would not have been possible. He was the heart. Now he disconnects with the heart. When these three meditations are completed, the fourth happens. He is no more a person, no more a farm, no more a wave. He disappears into the ocean. He becomes that which he had always been. He becomes that which he had known 42 years before, but was somehow managing to help people. His death is a tremendous experiment in meditation. And it is said many who were present, just seeing him moving slowly, slowly, first they saw the body is no more the same. Something has happened. The aliveness has disappeared from the body. The body is there, but like a statue. Those who were more perceptive, more meditative, they immediately saw that now the mind has been dropped and there is no mind inside. Those who were even more perceptive could see that the heart is finished. And those who were really on the verge of Buddhahood, seeing Buddha disappear, they also disappeared. Many disciples became enlightened the day Buddha died. Many. Just seeing him dying, they have watched him living. They have seen his life. But now came the crescendo, the climax. They saw him dying. Such a beautiful death. Such grace, such meditativeness. Seeing it, many were awakened to be with a Buddha, to live with a Buddha, to be showered by his love is a blessing. But the greatest blessing is to be present when a Buddha dies. You can simply ride on that energy. You can simply take a quantum leap with that energy. Because Buddha disappearing, and if your love is great, and your connection is deep, it is bound to happen. It is going to happen to many of my sannyasins. The day I will disappear, many of you are going to disappear with me. Vivek again and again says to me, I don't want to live a single moment when you are gone. And I say to her, you don't be worried. Even if you want to live, you will not be able. Just the other day, Diksha was saying to Vivek, that once Bhagwan is gone, I am gone. That is true. But this is not only true about Vivek and Diksha, this is true of many of you. And this is not something that you have to do. It will simply happen on its own accord. It will be an happening. But it is possible only if you allow total trust to happen, while I am alive, if you allow total trust to happen, then you can move with me in my death too. If there is a little doubt, you will think, but I have not done many things and I have to live my life. I know that it is said that the Master is leaving, and I know it would have been far better if he was alive. But I have many things to do. I have to live my life. And 1001 desires. If there is a little doubt, it will create 1001 desires. But if there is no doubt, then the death of the Master is the most liberating experience that has ever happened on this earth. Buddha was very fortunate to have great disciples. Jesus was not so fortunate. His disciples were cowards. While he was dying, they had all escaped. While he was on the cross, they had escaped miles away in the fear they may be caught. After 3 days, when there is stone in front of the tomb where his body was kept was removed, there was not a single one of the apostles, but Mary Magdalene, the prostitute, and another Mary. Two women had gathered courage. The disciples were so afraid that if they go to see what has happened to the Master's body or to take the Master's body, they may be caught. Only two women had enough love. When Jesus' body was taken down from the cross, then too, three women were taking the body down. All those great apostles were not there. Jesus was not very fortunate. And the reason is clear. He was starting something new. In the East, Buddhas have existed for millions of years. The Western concept of time is not right. The Western concept of time is very small. It is because of Christianity, it is very small. Christian theologians have even calculated when the world was created. March 23rd, I was wondering why not 21st? God missed only by 2 days. 23rd, 4004 years before Christ, the world was created. A very small idea of time. The world has existed for millions of years. Now science is coming closer and closer to the Eastern concept of time. In the East, Buddhas have existed for thousands and thousands of years. So we know how to be with a Buddha, how to live with him, how to trust him, and how to be with him when he is dying, and how to die with him. Much of it has been forgotten by a courtesy of Christianity and Western education. The modern Indian is not Indian at all. It is very difficult to find Indians in India. Almost impossible. Only once in a while I come across an Indian. Sometimes it happens that people who are coming from far away countries are far more Indian than the so-called Indians. 300 years of Western domination, Western education have completely made Indian mind disoriented. The Western mind is coming closer and closer to understand Buddhas more than the Eastern mind itself. And the reason is, the West is getting fed up with technology, science is becoming more and more hopeless, has seen that what the science has promised, it has not been able to fulfill. In fact, it has seen that all the revolutions have failed. And now there is only one revolution left, the inner. The revolution of the individual. The revolution that is brought by inner transformation. Indians are still hoping that a little better technology, a little better government, a little more money, a little more production, and things will be all perfectly well. The Indian mind is hoping, is very materialistic. The modern Indian is more materialistic than any country is. The materialist countries are fed up with materialism. It has failed. They are disappointed, disillusioned. So let me tell you, my sannyasins are more Indians. They may be Germans, they may be Norwegians, they may be Dutch, they may be Italians, French, English, Americans, Russians, Czechs, Japanese, Chinese. They are far more Indian. Journalists again and again come and ask, why don't we see more Indians here? And I say, they are all Indians. Just there are few foreigners. Just few. Whom you think that they are Indians. Just those few foreigners. Otherwise they are all Indians. To be an Indian has nothing to do with geography. It has something to do with an inner approach towards reality. The modern India has forgotten the ways of the Buddha, has forgotten how to live with Buddhas. I am trying to reveal that treasure again to you. Let it sink deep in your heart. The first principle is the art of living. Be life affirmative. Life is synonymous with God. You can drop the word God. Life is God. Live with reverence, with great respect, gratitude. You have not earned the life. It has been a seer gift from the beyond. Feel thankful and prayerful. And take as many bites of it as possible. And chew well. And digest well. Make your life an aesthetic experience. And not much is needed to make it an aesthetic experience. Just an aesthetic consciousness is needed. A sensitive soul. Become more sensitive, more sensuous, and you will become more spiritual. Priests have almost poisoned your body in a state of death. You are carrying paralyzed bodies and paralyzed minds and paralyzed souls. You are moving on crutches. Throw all those crutches. Even if you have to fall and crawl on the ground, that is better rather than to cling to crutches. And experience life in all possible ways, good, bad, bitter, sweet, dark, light, summer, winter. Experience all the dualities. Don't be afraid of experience, because the more experience you have, the more mature you become. Search all possible alternatives. Move in all directions. Be a wanderer, a vagabond of the world of life and existence. And don't miss any opportunity to live. Don't look back. Only fools think of the past. Fools who have no intelligence to live in the present. And only fools imagine of the future, because they don't have the courage to live in the present. Forget the past, forget the future. This moment is all. This moment has to become your prayer, your love, your life, your death, your everything. This is it. And live courageously. Don't be cowards. Don't think of consequences. Only cowards think of consequences. Don't be too much result-oriented. People who are result-oriented miss life. Don't think of goals, because goals are always in the future and far away, and life is here now, close by. And don't be too much purposive. Let me repeat it. Don't be too much purposive. Don't always bring the idea, what is the purpose of it? Because that is a strategy created by the enemies of you, by the enemies of humanity, to poison your very source of life. Ask the question, what is the purpose of it? And everything becomes meaningless. It is early morning, the sun is rising, and the east is red with the sun, and the birds are singing, and the trees are waking up, and it is all joy. It is a rejoicing. A new day has again happened. And you standing there, ask the question, what is the purpose of it? And you miss. You miss it totally. You are simply disconnected. A rose flower is dancing in the wind. So delicate and yet so strong. So soft. Yet fighting with the strong wind, so momentary, yet so confident. Look at the rose flower. Have you ever seen any rose flower nervous? So confident, so utterly confident, as if it is going to be here forever. Just a moment's existence. And such trust in eternity. Dancing in the wind, whispering with the wind, sending its fragrance, and you standing there, ask the question, what is the purpose of it? You fall in love with a woman and ask the question, what is the purpose of it? You are holding the hand of your beloved or your friend and ask the question, what is the purpose of it? And hence you are still holding, but now life has disappeared. Your hand is dead. Raise the question, what is the purpose? And everything is destroyed. Let me tell you, there is no purpose in life. Life is its own purpose. It is not a means to some end. It is an end unto itself. The bird on the wing, the rose in the wind, the sun rising in the morning, the stars in the night, a man falling in love with a woman, a child playing on the street. There is no purpose. Life simply enjoying itself, delighting in itself. energy overflowing, dancing, for no purpose at all. It is not a performance. It is not a business. Life is a love affair. It is poetry. It is music. Don't ask ugly questions like, what is the purpose? Because the moment you ask it, you disconnect yourself from life. Life cannot be bridged with philosophical questions. Philosophy has to be put aside. Be poets of life. Singers, musicians, dancers, lovers. And you will know the real philosophy of life. Philosophia perennis. And if you know how to live, and it is a simple art, trees are living, and nobody is there to teach them. In fact, they must be laughing, seeing that you have asked such a question. They must be giggling. You may not be able to hear their giggle, the whole existence is non-philosophical. If you are philosophical, then a gap arises between you and existence. Existence simply is for no purpose. And the person who really wants to live has to get rid of this idea of purpose. If you start living without any purpose, with intensity, totality, love and trust, when death will come, you will know how to die. Because death is not the end of life, but only an episode in life. If you have known other things, if you have lived other things, you will be able to live death too. The real man of understanding lives his death as much as he lives his life, with the same intensity, with the same thrill. Socrates was so much thrilled when he was going to be given poison. The poison was being prepared outside his room. His disciples had gathered. He was lying on the bed, ready, because the time was coming closer, 6 o'clock, exactly as the sun sets, he will be given the poison. People were not even breathing. The clock was coming closer and closer to 6 o'clock. And this beautiful man will be gone forever. And he has not committed any sin. His only sin was that he used to tell truth to people. That he was a teacher of truth. That he will not compromise. That he will not bow down to the stupid politicians. That was his only crime. He has not done any harm to anybody. And Athens will remain poorer forever. In fact, with the death of Socrates, Athens died. Then it never had the same glory again. Never. It was such a crime to kill Socrates that Athens committed suicide. Greek culture never reached to any other height again. Few days, it continued. Echoes of Socrates, because Plato is his disciple, just an echo. And Aristotle is Plato's disciple, echo of an echo. Slowly, slowly, as the echoes of Socrates disappeared, Greek culture disappeared from the world. It had seen days of glory, but it committed suicide by murdering Socrates. Disciples were very much disturbed, but Socrates was so thrilled as a small child when you take him to the exhibition. He's so thrilled by everything, each and everything. It's so incredible. He will get up again and again and go to the window and ask the man who was preparing the poison, why you are delaying? Now it is 6 o'clock. And the man said, are you mad, Socrates, or something? I'm delaying just so that a beautiful man like you can stay a little longer. I cannot delay forever, but this much I can do. A little bit more. Linger a little bit more. Why you are in such a hurry to die? Socrates said, life I have known. Life I have lived. I know the taste of life. Now, I am so curious about death. That's why I am in such a hurry. I am pulsating with a great joy. The very idea that now I am going to die and I will be able to see what death is. I want to taste death. I have tasted everything else. Only one thing has remained unknown. I have lived life and known all that life can give. This is the last gift of life. And I am really intrigued. The man who has lived, really lived, will know how to die. Vandana, there is no art of death. The art of life is the art of death, because death is not something separate from life. Death is the highest peak of life, the Everest. The virgin snow covers sunlit Everest. It is the most beautiful thing in existence. But you can know the beauty of death only if you know the beauty of life. Life prepares you for death. but people are not living at all. They are hampered in every possible way from living. So they don't know what life is, and consequently they will not know what death is. Death is a lie. You don't end with it. Only you take a turn. You move on another road. You disappear from this road. You appear on another road. If you are not yet awakened, enlightened, here you die, there you are born. You disappear from one body and you appear immediately into some womb, because millions of foolish people are copulating all over the world. They are just waiting for you. And there are really so many that it is good that you die unconscious and you choose the new womb unconsciously. If it was a conscious choice, you will go crazy. How to choose? Whom to choose? Unconsciously you die. Unconsciously you are born to the closest possible womb that fits with you. One body is gone, another is immediately formed. But if you are enlightened, and what do I mean by enlightened? I mean if you have lived your life with awareness, and you have reached to the point of awareness where no dark spot of any unconsciousness exists in you, then there is no more any womb for you. Then you enter into the womb of God, existence itself. That is liberation, moksha, nirvana. The last question. Bhagwan Morarji Desai once said that if he did set up a commission to investigate us, we would not like the results. If the government does set up a commission, is there any hope at all of its being really open, really impartial? Krishna Prem, politics can never be impartial. Politics is partiality. Politics can never be unprejudiced. It is rooted in prejudice. So don't hope much. It will be fun, that's all. We will enjoy the people who will come in the commission. enjoy them if he appoints any commission and the people come here and enjoy. Give them a feel of your life that is happening here. Who knows? Somebody may be turned on. But don't trust politicians. The game with politicians is a dangerous game. Friendship is dangerous with them. Enmity is dangerous with them. But it cannot be avoided. And what is happening here is so huge that politicians cannot remain out of it long. Just the other day, in the Indian Parliament, they discussed again, a long discussion. A phone call came from Delhi that sent Krishna Prem, Madhura and other press people, because now this is the only hot thing that people are talking about. We are not interested in politicians, in politics. Not at all. But we cannot avoid them either. Politics is like the weather, whether you like it or not. Anyway, it is going to affect you. It is known now why Nasir suddenly died of a heart attack. He received a telephone call from Golda Meir, who told him, "Let us make love, not war." Now, whether you make love or you make war with politicians, it is going to be difficult going, tough going. So Krishna Prem, there is no need to hope anything. In the first place, I don't think he is going to appoint a commission. For many reasons. One reason is, the other day in the parliament, somebody raised the question that why the commission only for Rajneesh? And a great shiver went into the whole parliament. It is reported in the newspapers. Because the man says that they appoint a commission to investigate Satya Sai Baba, Guru Maharaj Ji, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, Muktanand, and other etc. etc. Nandas. They were very happy to have a commission investigate my place, my commune, but now the fear. And that looks logical. If you want to investigate one commune, then why not all? That is the first problem they will have to face. Secondly, just to avoid to escape from appointing the commission, because who knows if the commission comes, because the people who come and go back to him, they report that all that appears in the newspapers is false. It is not the true picture. So many people who have visited the ashram, and so many members of the parliament have come, and whosoever has come has reported to him that you are unnecessarily prejudiced. Something beautiful is happening. A meeting of East and West is happening. So he is afraid also deep down that who knows, the commission may report favorably, then what he is going to do. And once the commission reports favorably, it will become a great problem for him. So to escape from appointing the commission, he has found a very legal way. He asks that I should write a personal letter to him that a commission should be appointed to investigate me and my work. He knows perfectly well that for 5 years I have stopped writing personal letters. And why should I write a personal letter? If the government wants to know what is happening, that is their work to know. If they have decided without investigating, they are being undemocratic. If they say to the world that we will not allow any television companies from Holland, from England, from Japan, from Australia to cover the work and the commune, because it will not represent the true Indian spirit and the true Indian image, if they have decided it without investigating at all, this is their duty to appoint a commission. Why should I ask them to appoint a commission? But this is a legal trick. He knows I don't write personal letters for 5 years. I have not done, and I'm not going to do it. And then he is worried also that he said in the parliament other day. He said, because he has not received a personal letter from me, and it is always Yoga Lakshmi, the managing trustee, who writes, and she writes that Bhagwan is only a guest in the commune. So how we can investigate a guest? But Lakshmi is right. I am simply a guest of you. and I don't do anything. So what they are going to investigate? They can come and sit with me 24 hours in my room. I don't do anything. There is nothing to investigate. The question is of the commune. The work that goes on in the commune, that has to be investigated. But he is not interested in the commune. His interest basically is somehow to create a trap in which he can catch me, because he knows if I am caught or if I am imprisoned, then the whole work will be destroyed easily. The other day in the parliament he said it, unconsciously it must have come out of him, that Rajneesh is the ashram, Rajneesh is the commune. So we cannot investigate the commune unless I write. And I'm not going to write. And I don't think politicians of any worth, I don't think they are worthy to investigate a religious commune. In fact, someday we should think of appointing a commune to investigate the politicians. Three prime ministers of three great countries are sitting at a dinner party when all of a sudden a loud fart is heard coming from the seat where the lady host was dining. She is barely able to hold herself together when immediately from across her table the French prime minister stands up and in a loud, firm voice exclaims, "Excuse me, Messieurdom, but I must unexpectedly leave. I am not feeling well." Grateful and relieved, the lady manages to regain her composure when 10 minutes later she lets another fart escape. Dismayed and blessing up to her ears, she watches how the English Prime Minister stands up and declares, "I am sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but I must retire early tonight. I am not feeling well." The scene happens once more, and this time the Indian Prime Minister proudly stands up and says loudly, "Well, now, ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor and my duty to go home." Get it? I don't have any respect for these politicians, political leaders. I have respect for them as human beings, but not as politicians. Politics is the most ugly phenomenon on the earth. And the politicians, the ugliest human beings. I have tremendous respect for human beings, but I can't have any respect for the ugly politics that goes on. There is no need to have any hope. First, they will not appoint any commission, afraid that it may turn against them, and it is not going to be easy either. If they appoint a commission, we are going first to give tough tests for the commission too, whether they are really able to investigate a commune, what they know about it, what they know about the therapies that are going on here. First, they will be examined. A group of 50 therapists will examine them in every possible way. Unless we are satisfied that they are worthy to investigate, we won't allow them inside the gate. First, they are not going to appoint. He is afraid whom to appoint. Where they are going to find people who understand primal therapy, bioenergetics, encounters, psychodrama, psychosynthesis, psychoanalysis. And he is afraid if he appoints somebody who understands these things, he will be in our support. He can appoint a retired senile judge, but he will not know anything about, and that will be really hilarious. I don't think he is going to appoint, but if he appoints, enjoy it. Let them come and have real fun about the whole thing. At least let them carry some joy, some laughter from here. What they report is irrelevant, because what happens almost always is this: before they will come here, the report will already be ready. That's what happens. The report will be prepared by somebody else. But we are not interested in their reports. I had told only to appoint a commission so that the government at least can have a show of democracy. It is utterly undemocratic to prevent media people reaching to Pune. It is so undemocratic to tell people, now we have letters in our possession. To one sannyasin, the American ambassador wrote, that if you want to go to Rajanis, then forget all about it. We are not going to give you any entry visa. But if you want to go to any other ashram, you write and we are ready to give it to you. Just see the foolishness of the man writing it. Now in Bombay, on the passports of sannyasins, they are writing that this visa is not valid for Pune. So it seems Pune is no more part of India. A tourist is entitled to tour the whole of India except Pune. But why prevent people from Pune? Just Koregaon Park would have been enough. They are doing in every possible way whatsoever they can do to hassle, to hinder. They have tried one thing that they are very clever in doing, to find out some flaw in our finances. They have not been able to do it. Sadly, the finance minister has to declare yesterday in the parliament that their finance is absolutely okay and we could not find any flaw in it. So now they are at a loss what to do. In fact, there is nothing that they can find which is being done against the law. But just their prejudices, just their old rotten minds, just their traditional minds, they cannot believe that a phenomenon like me is even possible in India. But it is happening and it is going to grow. It is growing. And the more they will hinder, the more it will grow. That is the inner logic of things. The more hindrances, the more challenges, the more it is going to grow. If Jesus was not crucified, there would have been no Christianity. If one day the politicians decide to crucify me, I will be the happiest person in the world. Enough for today.